Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If Donald Trump keeps faith with his promises in any way, and that's an open question, and I don't believe he will do the no tax on tips. I don't believe he will do the no tax on Social Security. I don't believe he will do the no tax on overtime. But he will do the tariffs. Mm-hmm. And he will make some effort to do the deportation of illegal aliens, which he has not thought through at all. And we are very soon going to have some network of some system of surveillance and detention. And when Americans see that, they are not going to like it one bit.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and The Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is The Atlantic's David Frum. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is not where we hoped we would be a week ago, and it was a very short evening, as it turned out, instead of the protracted counting that many of us were anticipating. Maybe that's a good thing, but at least it didn't stretch out. At least there were no cries of a stolen election. It's amazing that the deep state stole the 2020 election and then forgot how to do it this time. That's interesting. But here's where we are. Everybody here has already sort of provided analysis about what happened, but let's start with Bill Galston about the mistakes that you think were made by the Harris campaign, and what you think your view, as I understand it, is that the Trump people had a better scheme about what the election was about.
Well, I do think they had a better theory of the case.
Yeah, that's Harris. What I was trying to say.
Yeah, and Harris bet on abortion and democracy as vote movers. And as it turned out, neither of them moved votes. And Trump bet on inflation and immigration and an all-out appeal to men. And his plan did move votes demonstrably. Having said that, I think Harris was hampered by decisions that Joe Biden made in 2021. One of them was a non-decision. Number one, the decision to go big on the American Rescue Plan poured gasoline on an inflation fire that was only beginning to rage. Number two, he wiped out Trump's border policies and replaced them with nothing. Number three, he wanted to get out of Afghanistan in the worst possible way. And sure enough, we got out of Afghanistan in the worst possible way. And number four, sometime during the first 2 years of his administration, he decided that rather being a transitional president, he was indispensable to the future of the republic, and decided, as someone at that point already 8 years of age, that it was just a wonderful idea to run for office again. And had it not been for those four decisions, I submit that we'd be having a very different discussion today. Would the outcome have been different? No. But the context within which Biden's successor, which may or may not have been Kamala Harris, would have been entirely different.
Wait, I don't understand. You said, would the outcome have been different? And then you answer no. What do you mean?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay, please explain.
Okay, what I said was not necessarily, but there wouldn't have been so much headwind in the Democratic nominee's face. Indeed, it is entirely possible if those four decisions had been different, that Mr. Biden would have been enjoying the glow of a successful transitional president, and that his successor would have had a coin flip shot of winning the election, you know, as opposed to being, as Harris correctly said from the beginning of her campaign, the underdog. She knew what she was talking about, and she was right about that. She was wrong about other things, but I've already spoken long enough.
So David, from some people look at the fundamentals here and say, well, yeah, the Biden administration certainly made its share of errors, and Biden shouldn't have chosen to run again and then dropped out with only 3 months to spare, and so on. But if you look at the way voting has happened in the free elections that we've had around the globe since the post-pandemic inflation, in almost every case, with very few exceptions, the incumbent party has been punished for if they were in charge when the inflation began. What do you make of that analysis?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. In the United States, there are the additional factors of the open border and criminal disorder in a lot of big cities. There's an op-ed in the New York Times today in which somebody had the creativity and imagination to suggest that Democrats lost because they didn't do enough about Gaza. And I think there's one sense in which that's true, because there's something a Democrat should have said about Gaza, which is if you block a bridge, you go to jail. That's what they should have said about Gaza. I don't care what you're protesting, go to jail. And you know what? And if you steal from a Walgreens, you go to jail. And in fact, there are a lot of things for which people should go to jail. We stopped sending people to jail in 2014. We got a crime wave under Trump, and we're going to send more people to prison for committing crimes. Those are the kinds of things that were aggravating factors. But we ought not to lose sight of the fact that the American economy is doing really well. And I think one of the things that people need to be careful about in these opinion-forming days after the election is if you accept the theory that there's something wrong with the American economy, then when in about 3 months' time, when Donald Trump starts taking credit for it, you're going to have exceeded in advance his crazy claim. You know why we have a border? There are many reasons we have a border crisis. Lacks controls, a broken asylum system. Also, the United States is running the hottest job market on the planet and has been running the hottest job market on the planet for 2 years. And the word has gone out from the Congo to China. If you're looking for work, the one place you are certain to find it is in the United States. And if you have to pay $10,000 to get there, or $20,000 or $30,000, which is what it costs, that investment will be amply repaid by the incredible opportunities that are going on in Joe Biden's America. So that's something we need to keep in mind, because in 3 months, this economy is going to suddenly be transformed in so many people's versions of the truth, from a basket case to what it is. It is in many what is true, which is the strongest economy since the 60s, and with a price problem in the first 2 years of that expansion, but one that has now come under control.
It has come under control. And, it's now lower than the inflation rate was in January of 2020. And so, Linda, this raises the question about a failure of storytelling that the Harris campaign and the Biden administration before her, they failed to tell a story about inflation. And to say, look, yeah, it was really high. It was a worldwide phenomenon. Bill cites the American Rescue Plan, which, you know, probably played a role, but it was a worldwide phenomenon as well. And it did have something to do with supply chains and other dislocations post-pandemic. And they could have said, you know, so in 2012, when Obama was running for re-election, The economy still had not completely recovered from the Great Recession. And when Obama was running, he told a story about the economy. He said, well, yes, I mean, it hasn't completely come back, but we're on the right track. The last administration, he claimed, drove it into a ditch. And so it takes a long time to dig it out. And people were willing to give the Obama administration some credit for that and some grace because there was a story there. The Biden administration and the Harris campaign never told a story about how inflation had been brought under control and that it was, you know, that prices eventually, you know, that wages were now up and that it was a matter of being patient and that, you know, these things are being resolved. They didn't tell that story. Do you think that was a mistake or no? You're grimacing.
I have to say, I don't agree with that. I don't think it was just a matter of storytelling. I don't do grocery shopping in my family. My husband does it. So I looked up the price of eggs and what it was in 2019 before the pandemic and what it is today. A dozen eggs cost $2.36 in December of 2019. They cost $3 a dozen today. You and I understand that inflation, number one, is cumulative. So even if it's going up at a lower rate than it was, it's still going up. We don't have deflation, and hope to God we don't get deflation. That would be a disaster for the economy. But if you're a mother trying to put food on the table and you're going to the grocery store and things are simply more expensive, filling your grocery cart costs more, you're going to feel it. You're going to notice it. Same thing with gas. Gas is suddenly down to, you know, in the low $3, but it was under $2 before the pandemic. And so I think people notice those things. And I think it's very hard to tell a story about that. I think the biggest problem was you couldn't tell any story when the candidate was a continuation of the Biden presidency. And the vice president, I thought she did a terrific job. She inspired me. I don't agree with her on policy stuff, but I thought she was a really good candidate. I found her pro-American speeches uplifting. But people were very dissatisfied with the Biden administration. He had 40% approval. How do you overcome that? I don't know what kind of story you can tell without in some way totally breaking. And Biden didn't give his party a chance to do that because he insisted on holding on and not making a decision until, you know, a minute or two before the bell rang in the game. And I think that was the biggest problem.
So, Damon, a number of people have been critical of Harris for not separating herself more from Biden. I know from last week and from what you've written, you don't necessarily think she had that option. I would also just observe, as my colleague Andrew Egger noted, that one of the reasons that she had a problem running away from Biden is that because of the way she had run in 2019 as a, you know, basically a very progressive candidate, she had to really embrace Biden to escape that legacy. And so, you know, she was sort of captured in a vice. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think there's something to that, definitely. I mean, I think one area where she was continually plagued by the kind of the legacy of her 2019 run was on trans issues. Now, I don't think that trans issues is like a major wedge issue for most voters. I think most voters don't even know what the heck is going on with that.
I don't agree with that. I think they know very well.
Well, depends on who you're talking about. It's a big country. And I think they might know about it from seeing news reports on Fox about it, but like how much it comes up in their daily lives, I'm a little skeptical about. However, the Trump people ran really devastating ads, especially I know locally in southeastern Pennsylvania.
based on this video that she ran about paying for trans surgery of prisoners. And then you do a little bit of inference and it's easy to see, oh, she must also mean if these are like people who are here illegally and end up
in jail. It was a trifecta.
Yeah, it was, and they played it over and over and over again, which just, even if aside from the narrowness of the trans issue, it was so bad for a candidate who was trying to run away from her earlier, more lefty incarnation to a more reasonable, moderate position that had to go along with a kind of implicit message of, and you can trust the person I'm saying I am now is who I will be for the next 4 years. It wasn't so much that people, you know, I think like you, Mona, and like me, I didn't really loved her speech at the DNC, really thought she held her own against Trump in the debate. Loved other comments she made that sounded very patriotic, like the events with Liz Cheney and so forth. But the problem is whether people believed that she was stable in that new orientation. And they're like, is that really the person who will be president for the next 4 years? Or if the polls shift, if expediency in the Democratic Party changes, will she become something else that I didn't vote for? That, I think, was a factor. I do think it was there was a lot going on here with inflation, with immigration, and then, you know, other stuff that I've also written about recently about just a general pervasive grumpiness among a lot of Americans about the competence and trust in our government institutions, and just a sense that when things either go wrong, mistakes get made by people in power, or even just disagreeing with policy, like say over some of the COVID regulations, closing schools and so forth, that there's never any real accountability, or like no one ever stands up and says, I made a mistake and we need to do an investigation of this and learn from it. Now, part of this is, I think, driven by our polarized moment. I mean, back, you know, 50 years ago when stuff like that happened, you'd have a bipartisan commission that would issue reports and it had a kind of legitimacy because it sort of hovered above the partisanship of the moment. But of course, we live at a time where if the Democrat admits they make a mistake, it's like the Republicans will just make partisan hay of it. No one will join a committee to investigate it. And then it's up to the Democrats to sort of do it themselves. But that seems like kind of counterintuitive as politics. Like we're going to have hearings to prove that we screwed this up, where the Republicans are constantly using it to take pot shots. It's like a candidate doing oppo research on themselves and publicizing it. So it's a big, we have lots of problems, and you know, for God's sake, Donald Trump is on track. He's right now at 50.9% of the popular vote, my friends. We're in a bad way in this country right now. And we have lots and lots of work to do over the next 45 minutes and then going forward and figuring out how the hell we got here and how we get out of it.
Can I add a footnote to the point about so-called trans issues? I think it's part of a larger story. The most important word in a liberal's vocabulary is no. In the same way, the most important word in a conservative's vocabulary is yes. So when you get handed by some interest group a survey that says, are you for sex changes for illegal aliens? The correct answer is this a prank? No. And it's not because of any, it's just what they're doing, that interest group is testing you to say, are you so broken that you can't say no to any liberal demand, including one that looks exactly like a prank? Sex changes for illegal aliens, like you take all the things and put them into one thing. I assume these are free, right? Like the illegal alien, yeah, it's right. Entirely 100% taxpayer provided. There's not even a copay. It's like 100% free money for illegal aliens, so sex change operation. No, obviously not. I'm not for that.
In the same way, Charlemagne the God said he was against it.
Right. The same way that, you know, the you know, Because they're like, would you? You see a hobo on the street, will you give him $5? The conservative answer is sure. Yeah, I want to help people out because you need to play. You just need to remind yourself you're not a joke. You're not a parody of yourself. You're not a complete cartoon. And so those moments in 2019, 2020, when Democrats went along with being complete cartoons, that's a problem. But here's, if we retain the right to have free elections in the United States, which is a little more of a question mark right now than it usually is or than it is comfortable to be, we can also see how the process of regeneration can occur to put some constraints on this very dangerous administration, because they're going to start doing things. Because they can't say yes, because they can't say no to their interest groups. If Donald Trump keeps faith with his promises in any way, and that's an open question, and I don't believe he will do the no tax on tips. I don't believe he will do the no tax on Social Security. I don't believe he will do the no tax on overtime. But he will do the tariffs, mm-hmm. and he will make some effort to do the deportation of illegal aliens, which he has not thought through at all. And we are very soon going to have some system of surveillance and detention. And when Americans see that, they are not going to like it one bit. People mocked Mitt Romney for his self-deportation idea. The idea was he said, if you enforce legality at the workplace and employers are required to check that people are here legally and the people who are illegally can't get work, they will go home and they will buy their own ticket. And you won't even know you will never know they were in the country and you won't know that they're not in the country. They will make their own decisions in their own way with some dignity attached. And I think Americans would have accepted that. They're not going to accept what's coming. They're not going to accept what happens if Trump and as Trump imposes tariffs. And they're not going to like the unbelievable spasm of corruption that is coming. Unbelievable. Trump won was the most corrupt administration in American history by far, but it is going to be remembered as a very distant runner-up to the staggering corruption of Trump II.
Yeah, I was going to get to that later, but since you raised it, I'll turn now to Bill. Bill, the topic of the coming corruption just cannot be emphasized too strongly. You know, we have the specter of Elon Musk, who may have many agendas, but certainly among them, it's very obvious. What does Elon Musk want out of this administration? Well, he doesn't want any competition for Tesla from Chinese-made vehicles. That's easy. And we can see that you repeat that, you know, wash and repeat for any number of industrialists and others who are going to be going to Trump and making deals that will line Trump's pockets. And we do have something new under the sun in America now, in that Trump has flagrantly violated rules, norms, and the law and gotten away with it. And now the voters have ratified his actions. And so who is going to hold him to account in a second term when this corrupt, you know, parade begins?
The voters. I'm with David on this one. You know, I do think we'll have a midterm election.
I do too.
For the ordinary one, I do think we'll have another presidential election. You know, Trump will now turn on a dime and says that he and will say he loves elections. Why not? you know, if Trump has made an enormous number of promises, not only to private parties, but also to the American people. I think that these promises have been so sweeping and so unequivocal that not only will he not be able to honor them, but it will be very apparent to everybody that he won't be able to honor them. And if the Republicans are not very careful, you know, they're going to have a big backlash election in 2 years. And if you look at the setup of the Senate seats that will be contested in 2026, you know, it's the mirror image of what the Democrats were facing this year. So, and another thing that's going to happen, I confidently predict, since I've lived through these cycles before, is that after the circular firing squad of Democrats subsides, There is going to be a lot of serious thinking and a lot of party reinvention. I'm not promising that it will come to a successful conclusion within 4 years, but I can tell you, as the veteran of a previous cycle like this, it did come to a pretty good conclusion in 4 years. So, there's an old IWW slogan that I believe was coined by Joe Hill. Yes, you know, you're learning what kind of family I come from. When he was
I heard the folk song anyway.
He was about to be executed. He told his followers, "Don't mourn, organize." That would be good advice. Either all of Trump's policies work as advertised, in which case his slogan, "There's going to be a new golden age in America," which was unveiled at his, victory speech, will turn out to be correct. And then this new magnified Republican Party will be like the Democratic Party of the 1930s, in power for a very long time. Or if I'm right and he won't be able to redeem these promises, then we're in for another turn of the political screw in a very different direction.
Linda, when presidents come into office, there's a huge long list of agenda items that they're going to attend to, some of it having to do with promises they've made, some of it having to do with interest groups that are part of their coalitions who have demands and want things to be done. And then when it comes time for elections, the voters basically make a calculation upon whether to reelect this person based on how's the economy, and how's foreign relations? Are we at peace and is the economy strong? And maybe now we can add immigration is not out of control at the border. And if those things are okay, you're going to be reelected and all the rest of it. So, for example, Joe Biden made a huge gamble that he could woo working class voters from the Trump coalition, which, by the way, is now cemented. I think that's one lesson from this election, is that the working class is now Republican, full stop. The Democrats have lost them. And, of course, the Republicans have gained some upper middle class college educated voters, but it's not an equal trade. There are more working class voters. The Democrats have gained some of those college educated. So it's not an equal trade advantage to Republicans there. But Biden thought, well, I'll have all these big federal programs that will benefit the working class. And there'll be, all kinds of investments in manufacturing, green energy and various other things. And leaving aside whether those programs were good policy in terms of fighting climate change or other things, they certainly didn't do him any good at all in getting working class voters, right?
No, they didn't. But I guess I'm more pessimistic than David and maybe Bill and maybe you, Mona. I don't think when we have the congressional elections roll around that working class voters are going to be looking at whether or not he did what he said he was going to do. I mean, on the immigration issue, he never built the wall. He built a very small portion of it. And oh, by the way, the building of the wall, the increased security at the border, actually kept people who might have gone home during a more economic downturns in the United States. So, but they're not going to hold him responsible for that. And I am very concerned about the cultural shifts that have taken place in the United States. And I do think that they have played a very, very big role. I also think that Donald Trump is first and foremost an entertainer. I think a lot of the men, particularly the young men that voted him, they thought he was funny. When there were jokes about Puerto Rico is an island of garbage or, Latinos loving those babies and not pulling out. They thought it was funny. They identified with it. His celebrity, I think, says something about America. I've used this phrase before, the tabloidization of America and America's population. They aren't sitting focused on issues. They're reacting to a persona. It happens to be a persona that they identify with. And I am worried that that's not going to change. It changed a bit because of the pandemic, because he looked so inept. He was flailing. He kept getting on TV and saying stupid things. And I think people lost trust, particularly when they had relatives who got COVID, were sick and dying. But it's worked very, very well for him for a very long time. And one final thing, the thing I worry about most is that the Supreme Court of the United States has basically says anything that he does that is part of an official act will have the assumption of immunity. And so all of the corruption that we're talking about, a lot of that may take place in the form of official acts, and he may be totally off the hook in terms of being prosecuted for that.
Trump comes to office with hundreds of millions of dollars in judgments against him. There's the money he owes to E. Jean Carroll for his defamation after he accused her of lying about sexual assault. And there's the $400 million that he owes to the victims of his multi-level marketing scam. Out of office, Trump would have difficulty finding $400 million. President of the United States, Donald Trump, should have no difficulty. One obvious way is that Elon Musk buys Truth Social from him to fold into Twitter at some outrageously inflated price. But there are a lot of other people who find a lot of other ways to put money into his pockets. And Linda's right. The Supreme Court, all the federal courts, but especially the Supreme Court, they took the view about the Trump crimes, all the variety of them. Leave us out of this. Leave us out of this. We are any motion for delay, any way of avoiding coming to grips with this, we accept. Leave us out. And after January 25th, we'll decide. If he loses, we come down on him like a hammer. If he wins, we invent a whole new theory of presidential immunity that is more pulled out of thin air than Roe versus Wade ever was. It needs to be stressed. This was an amazing act of judicial imperialism. There's no textual basis. There's no constitutional basis. They just came up with a scheme that John Roberts thought he liked and that would serve the political interest that he was trying to serve. And then he wrote it down and said, like some confectioner. I mean, he was taking these strands of sugar and turned them into cotton candy.
Not only that, he had a three-tier system, just like Roe v. Wade. Yeah. it was just an amazing turnabout for the so-called textualists and originalists on the Supreme Court. Alas. But Damon, I want to get your reaction to what Linda said, because, it's certainly, obviously, it's true all about, how people perceive Trump's personality. But I wonder how much you think it's that and how much you think it's also that, as some of the exit polls showed, that people regarded Harris as being much more to the left than they thought Trump was to the right. And that suggests that there was a policy basis here. It wasn't just about personality.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll be dissatisfying in saying all of the above. Yeah. I mean, I think that when you're dealing with something this big, it's a lot of causes, a lot of things are happening. I think some people voted for Trump just because they were pissed about inflation. Then you add in other people who are more pissed about the border or both. That's a big chunk of them, kind of the more normie voters. Then you had the kind of, very online far right, which was a much smaller number of people and who would have voted for him anyway. You have then the MAGA types who just love Trump for all kinds of cultural reasons, mostly. And then you also, then there's the faction that I think Linda was mostly talking about, which is like the kind of what Matthew Walther has called the barstool conservative phenomenon. A lot of men, a lot of younger men who just, we talked 20 years ago about this as South Park conservatives. It's like, it's been around for a while and it's more potent now, which is young men who just don't like liberals wagging their fingers at them, constantly making them feel like they're being racist, sexist, xenophobic, so forth, correcting them, trying to get them to, see the error of their ways and reform and public, all of the imagery that we saw around the protests of 2020 about how this is like the Cultural Revolution, and you got to stand up in front of the masses and confess your sins. Like that whole vague dynamic that some people experience very concretely if they work in schools or around an institution that's dominated by liberalism, just aspects of the workplace in certain corporate sectors and
DEI training.
Yeah, DEI training. I don't like with some of the trans stuff. I sort of think like not everyone is encountering this all the time, but others do see it. And, you know, I know a few people who have actually lost jobs over these kinds of things. So that, like, the people who just want to say to this kind of finger wagging, reprimanding liberalism, say, up yours. I want to live without you making me feel like I'm a moral defective and you're my better. Go to hell. That is something too. And Trump is extremely good at demonstrating simply the way he talks and his complete disregard for any norms of niceties. The fact that he's just, I think David had a very, very good, either an essay or something he said on a podcast years ago that I ended up writing a column at the week about, like the jerk voter, like even people who aren't jerks themselves love that Trump is a jerk because it gives them permission to say up you to these people they don't like in the culture. And so it's like a bundle of all of that together is somehow the Trump coalition. That's how you get to almost 51% of the popular vote in 2024, apparently.
But Bill, some of us do not like the excesses of the progressive left and resent them, and nevertheless say, yeah, but the alternative here was nothing resembling the American mainstream or tradition. It was a radical departure. The voters said, no, they don't believe. And there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times, I think a couple, maybe 3 weeks before the election, asking Trump voters whether they took seriously the kinds of things he was saying about, the enemy within or, poisoning the blood or whatever else. And they said, nah, they don't believe that. He's not really a threat. How do you react to that?
Obviously, I've made my views very clear. I think he's much more of a threat than they think he is. But my views, the arguments of people like me, like you, like everybody on this show, cut no ice with these people. It doesn't matter what we think. And to them, anyway. And so the only thing that's going to change their minds is experience. And if Trump is serious about acting on some of his worst instincts, this is just a continuation of the argument I made before in a different venue, that will be noticed. And 90% of the people who are with him now will stick with him. But the remaining 10%, the people who made the difference between 47% and 51%, I think probably won't. If we're such great defenders of democracy, we ought to have a little bit more faith in democracy as a self-correcting mechanism. Now, granted, if there is obstruction of the normal action of that mechanism, that's a problem. But if we don't think that that's a very serious threat, then we have to believe that, the people you're talking about are going to notice. If we don't believe that, then what do we stand for?
David?
But can we be a little bit more fine-grained about this? Do we think that Trump will try to bypass the Senate advise and confirm process by having a lot of acting secretaries who couldn't pass second? Yes. So And do we think that the 51% will care? I don't think so. So the mechanisms of democracy are not quite as self-enforcing as we like. Do we think that Trump is going to get the money to pay his civil judgments in ways that we used to think were improper and probably illegal, and that there will be no consequences for it from any kind of from Congress or the courts? Yes, I think that. Will Trump continue to find some new way to take bribes and direct secret federal funds into his own pocket? Yes. So the mechanisms of democracy, I mean, I think if Trump were literally to start rounding up Democratic senators and holding them in prison, that probably would be a bridge too far for, you know, all but the most dedicated Trump supporters. The Wall Street Journal would, like, parse it and have, you know, this might be bad for Republicans in 2026, this mass round of Democratic senators, and we really strongly advise on. But I think in general, I think that it would be a problem for him. But the kinds of things that are actually going to happen, it's not the democracy switch isn't on or off. Was the United States a democracy before the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Yeah, kind of, mostly. Was it less democratic than it was after? Yes. If you start undoing a lot of restraints on arbitrary power, do we become less democratic? We will. It won't be no. We're not heading. One of the things I kept saying a lot in 2017 is there are a lot of stops on the railway line of bad before you get to Hitler Station. And I think we are going to rediscover that. Both those who say we are going to Hitler Station and those who say that's ridiculous. Well, you can take a stop or two on that train.
Yeah. Linda, let's look at what we think this will mean for the world. The United States is certainly in the next several years. We don't know how long this will continue, but for a while, the U.S. is going to have a very different posture internationally. How do you think this will play out? Is Trump now going to ally us with Putin, in effect?
He certainly is in Ukraine. I cannot imagine that there is not going to be immediate pressure on Zelensky to basically sit down at the negotiating table and accept a redrawing of the map of Ukraine. I just believe that will happen. And I believe that most Americans won't give a damn. And I think that is really dangerous. Ukraine is not doing well in the war right now. And they're now facing North Korean troops who, despite the sort of amusing story this morning that these North Korean troops have got access to the internet now, they're not looking on battle strategies on the internet. Internet, they're watching Pornhub, apparently. but, you know, this is a scary time. Germany's coalition is falling apart. Germany has been steadfast in their support to Ukraine. What's going to happen there? France, you know, we may have to rely on France to protect democracy. I don't know how much money I'm willing to put on that. You know, it is a really scary time on the international front. And I don't think that if China makes a move against Taiwan, that Trump will be there. I mean, there are some disastrous things that could happen. And I'm not confident that we are not in a much more dangerous place in terms of a much broader war in Europe, for example, with Trump in power than with Biden.
Damon, the Trump fans and Ross Douthat published an interview with two of them a couple of weeks ago, you know, talking about, you know, how foreign policy would be conducted under a Trump administration. And they are always saying that Trump's power of intimidation is such. He scares our adversaries so much that they wouldn't dare to try anything funny while he's at the helm. And yet, first of all, they did, but leaving that aside, his message and J.D. Vance's message has been so isolationist consistently that, you know, the other side are warmongers and they want to get us into all these wars and we don't want to get into any wars. We don't want any trouble with anybody. Please don't try to get us to do anything militarily. Those two things seem to me to be in direct conflict. If he's going around telling the world he doesn't want any military confrontation, and at the same time, he's so scary. I mean, what is he supposed to be scaring them with? A hissy fit?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that, but partly that's because I find this whole argument that, like, you know, the world was more peaceful when Trump was president because everyone was scared of the crazy man is one of the most bizarre claims I've ever heard. Like, that isn't how foreign policy works, international affairs. And I mean, especially, it may be one thing if people thought he was a crazy man and he had made very clear where his red lines were. But because then you would think, wow, he might like act really precipitously if we cross them. But the problem is that he was all over the place about what he claimed to care about. One week he's promising to rain fire and fury on North Korea. You know, a little while later, he's calling Kim Jong-un his best friend and they're sending love letters to each other. He's acting like Putin is like the most admirable guy on the planet while his own administration is doing a lot to arm Ukraine against Russia, which in that interview that Douthat conducted, like one of those guys, I forget his name, not Elbridge Colby, who I do think is a serious guy and worth arguing with, but the other guy, it was just ridiculous. He just made it seem as if, like, oh, well, this was all intentional. It was like cat and mouse, good cop, bad cop. Like, yeah, sure. And I wonder what Trump was saying to Putin in all those untranscribed private meetings that he was having with Putin. But in any case, there are kind of two dimensions to foreign policy for the future Trump administration that really unnerve me. One is what we're kind of talking about, which is that Trump really does view the world personally as a kind of 19th century sphere of influence, pure realpolitik realist. So basically, he wants to give Russia its sphere of influence, once China can have its sphere of influence, we'll have our sphere of influence. We might fight in a few places over exactly who gets what in the Middle East, but we clearly are on Israel's side and we're with the Sunni powers. We hate Iran. And so we'll decisively side that way. We'll foster an agreement between the Saudis and Israel and so forth. But other than that, pretty much let Russia do what it wants, China do what it wants, and we'll do what we want. It's like we have a kind of tripartite spheres of realpolitik in the world. That is a recipe for unbelievable destabilization and also a great ramping down of American power relative to its apex in the aftermath of the Cold War. It is very, very challenging to negotiate something like that. The vacuum that's left when we withdraw and back out of our commitments and what follows in behind that and how that impacts our interests, that scares me. It would scare me even if the wisest statesman on the planet were in charge overseeing it, but with Donald Trump at the helm, I don't know. That is pretty terrifying. Last short point that is the other level that this worries me is I really do worry, even if things remain relatively stable compared to what I fear in foreign affairs over the next 4 years, we have lived through in the last two decades George W. Bush, who was very unpopular in Europe, lots of recriminations around the world because of the Iraq War, and what it did to destabilize the Middle East in ways we're still dealing with. Then we had Obama, and there was elation in Europe and a lot of places. Then we get Trump, who goes 180 degrees in the opposite direction, tears up the many agreements that Obama made. Then Biden comes in. We're back, baby, propping up NATO, doing the AUKUS deal to check China and Asia and so forth, and it seems all fine. Now back to Trump. Every time this 180 flip happens, our power and prestige diminishes, even if after Trump, we elect someone who's saner and more reasonable and responsible. because people will learn they simply cannot trust us. We have multiple personality disorder. We're Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We are not stable. And that was not true in the Cold War from 1945 until the fall of the Berlin Wall and then beyond into the 90s up to the War on Terror. We were like a rock. It didn't matter if a Republican or a Democrat was in there. There were peripheral shifts of emphasis, but for the most part, everyone knew where we stood. And that has now been shredded, I am afraid. And that really worries me too.
The claim that the world was peaceful under the United States under President Trump was fully or partly committed to three hot shooting wars, one in Afghanistan, one against ISIS in the Middle East, and one often against Trump's own will, but in Ukraine, a war that started in 2014 and in which people were dying every year of Trump's administration. And the United States, when the president himself was not trying to blackmail Zelensky, the Ukrainian state was sending weapons to. And in this next administration, there are flashpoints that are unbelievably dangerous. Trump, on the one hand, will say, and his vice president would say, we're isolationists, we don't want to get involved. In the next breath, they say, we want to start a war in Mexico.
That's true.
And that this is a serious commitment that there's legislation. A number of Republican senators have. Now, it's not technically a war against Mexico because we're not attacking the Mexican state. What we're just the plan is to have a naval blockade of Mexico and to fire missiles into Mexico without the permission of the Mexican government and hoping that they will go along. But I've written about this. Why this is so reckless, but the cartels, Mexican cartels, by and large, do not use violence inside the United States. That's just one of their red lines, but they have the capacity to. And when violence starts emanating from the United States into Mexico, there is no guarantee that the violence won't flow back from Mexico into the United States. Trump has said in interviews that he does not intend to defend Taiwan. In fact, he's mad at Taiwan for making computer chips that are too good and too cheap, and they need to be punished for that crime. And the Chinese may believe him. India right now is conducting a campaign of assassination. There's at least one proven case in Canada. There's another suspected. There's a case in Britain, and there is an attempted case in the United States. Trump is very pally with the Indian Prime Minister Modi, who has ordered these things. It's clear that this campaign of assassination goes to the top. What happens when Modi says, let's find out what the permissions are with my good friend Donald Trump in charge, and let's do more in Canada and more in Britain and maybe some in the United States? And then I think there is this last point. The Trump vision is of some kind of blocking coalition with China. As Damon said, the three great spheres. But that vision is not obsolete because there are other emerging great powers too. India is a great power and one with its own interests. And the biggest idea that Obama ever had in foreign policy, and it was a correct idea, was that China is too big for the United States to balance on its own. It's going to need to conjure a new coalition. This is what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was all about. And that means, and unlike NATO, which is a coalition with very congenial people with shared values, this will be a very uncongenial coalition. We don't have a lot in common with Vietnam. We don't have a lot in common with Indonesia. And as the assassinations prove, we have less in common with India than we once might have hoped we did. But we're still going to need these partners to balance the power of China. And the thing they most want is access to the American marketplace. And if Trump won't give them that, ain't going to be no coalition. And then he's alone in the room with China defending Taiwan, which, as he points out, the United States on its own probably cannot do.
Yeah, Bill, on the matter of Taiwan, this is a perfect illustration of what is unique about Trump when it comes to managing American foreign policy. So almost any other leader, the American leader that you can imagine, would see the question of Taiwan as one that within the traditional context, the U.S. supports democratic allies against aggressors who would seek to harm them. And Trump doesn't see it that way at all. Trump, first of all, he would signal to China that they could succeed in aggressing against Taiwan by the way he handles Ukraine, right? I mean, that will be a clear signal to China that it's open season on Taiwan. But also, as David points out, he sees this matter only in terms of is Taiwan producing more chips than we are, and therefore do we want to punish them? And can we get some sort of a deal with China to buy more of our exports in exchange for giving away Taiwanese independence?
Let me lay out an alternative theory of the case. As I look at the Republican Party in the era of Trump, you know, there are three groups, and I'll leave it to people more familiar with the Republican Party to pronounce on the relative strengths of these three groups. Group number one, the traditionalists, people like Mitch McConnell, you know, who have been, whatever their other sins and aberrations may have been, staunch supporters of America's post-war role in the world, of our alliance structure, of supporting Ukraine, et cetera. Group number two, sort of the pull-the-plug isolationists. I'm not sure how many of them there are, but they sure make a lot of noise.
And one of them is now vice president.
One of them is now vice president. The third group, which we haven't talked about at all, which I think looked at structurally may turn out to be the most powerful, is the group that says, make Europe defend itself so that we can turn all of our attention to Asia and defending Asia and the Pacific against China. And Elbridge Colby is the leader of that pack, and he has a great deal of intellectual credibility within the foreign policy circle that has gathered around Trump. So that's point number one. We shouldn't assume that what Trump is saying about Taiwan, which he's speaking out of instinct and ignorance, a not infrequent combination on his part, we shouldn't assume that that is the last word on the subject, which brings me to the second part of my alternative theory of the case. There was a very interesting TikTok story in the Times just this morning about how Trump's campaign managers got him to change his mind on a series of questions that turned out to be very important to the success of his campaign, starting with the handling of the abortion issue, but not ending there. Unless these stories are dead wrong, Trump came into the room, you know, with very strong views on the subject. He listened carefully to the advice of people he knew were on his side. He thought about it. He talked with other people. He kicked the tires. And then he decided to do something against his initial instinct, and that is endorse the state approach to abortion. And then, you know, to double down a couple of weeks later and state publicly that if a national abortion ban came to his desk, he would veto it. Those decisions really helped him neutralize the effect of the abortion issue on the electorate, except for that portion of him that of it that was, you know, completely in the bag for the other side. So, look, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm sure everybody understands. I am not trying to whitewash this guy. You know, all I'm trying to do is present an alternative theory of the case that might produce a different result in the case of Taiwan in particular.
Yeah.
What I really think, but I'm afraid that the consequences for Ukraine are beyond question and intolerable.
Without getting into a microcosm on this, the Elbridge Colby idea on Taiwan amounts to this. You owe a big debt to the bank, and you want to reassure the bank that you can pay. So you default on the electric bill, you default on the cable bill, you default on the child support, and you hoard your money to show your bank that you can pay them. And the bank's going to say, you're a deadbeat. All those other defaults, you're going to default on us. The United States, to defend Taiwan, the United States needs partnerships. It cannot do it by itself, and it will not do it. If it is just the United States security guarantee to Taiwan, that's not going to happen. Trump is not wrong about that. So it only works if there is a large coalition of allies. And the coalition of allies are going to say, how do you treat your other allies? You defaulted on Ukraine. Your word is no good. Your credit is no good. We're not taking your word for anything. The Elbridge Colby idea is just a verbal formula. detached from anything. I always think that the people who call themselves realists are the biggest fantasists out there. It's the most radically misnamed foreign policy label, because they don't understand that credit matters. The United States keeps the peace without fighting because its word is good. And Donald Trump is a deadbeat, and its word is no good. And the Chinese will figure that out real fast.
Yep, 100%. Okay, let us now turn to our highlight or lowlight of the week, and we will get to that after a few words from our sponsor. Well, the temperatures are changing, and you may feel that you are sleeping too hot or too cold. If that's the case with you, check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature-regulating so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth and require three times less laundry. Again, those self-cooling properties with the silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA make sure that you sleep at the exact right temperature all night long, no matter the weather. You'll sleep better every night. So stop sleeping on bacteria. Sleep clean with Miracle. Miracle Made sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some five-star hotels. So go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. Whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo, Beg to Differ, at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer and use that code BEGTODIFFER to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to treat yourself. And we thank Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. All right, and now we can turn to our highlights and lowlights of the week. And let us begin with Damon Linker.
I figured, given the utter dominance of the news this week and our focus on the podcast today, I simply wanted to flag a couple of people who helped guide me through this election and left me feeling a little bit wiser throughout, and then confirmed that wisdom with the outcome. So the first is Ryu Teixeira, who has the Liberal Patriot Substack, who he runs with a bunch of other people. There are different people who write for it every day. His item usually appears on Thursdays and is my favorite of the bunch. They're all good, but I'm fond of his. And he has been consistently pushing to use the formulation Bill has been using today, that I think is a good one, the theory of the case. His theory of the case from the beginning has been that the Democrats need to move to the right on culture. And if they can do that, they can win. If they do not do that, they are going to cede the working class to the Republicans in a way that will do lasting damage to the party and to the country. And I've suspected all along that this was right, and I think the outcome of the election has vindicated it pretty thoroughly. He had a very hot item today, in fact, this Thursday, kind of saying, I told you so, and I think it's worth every ounce of it. The other person is Nate Cohn. I'm a poll guy. I live for the polls throughout all of this. I think a lot of pollsters didn't do great through this cycle. There was a lot of odd weighting of polls to try to find those missing Trump voters, and yet they still somehow managed to miss it. But Nate Cohn at the New York Times, he's their data guru guy, he diverged from a lot of big pollsters this year and made the case that these weights that they were imposing on the data to find the Trump voters were actually missing changes in the electorate because they were pegging their results to the results of 2020 and blinding themselves to gains that Trump was making among Hispanics and Blacks and other groups. And he said it with a lot of modesty, always with a lot of caveats that he could be wrong. But his polls with Siena College, I think, ended up being vindicated more than a few others. In general, the results are roughly where I think we're going to end up, within a point or two, swung more even toward Trump. But in general, he did very well, and I learned a lot from him and the essays he wrote about those polls. So both those guys, I think, did a great job.
Thank you. Linda Chavez.
Well, I think probably like many listeners of this podcast, Tuesday night was a devastating experience. I mean, it was deeply depressing. So I've been sort of looking for some things to point to give me hope. It isn't so much. I thought Bill's analysis was terrific. I agree with it in terms of what went wrong. But you can handle it one of two ways. Unfortunately, our friend Brett Stevens handled it by writing a column called A Party of Prigs and Pontificators Suffers a Humiliating Defeat. I didn't think that was a good way to handle it. Instead, I looked to someone whom I agree with often on human rights issues, and that is Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, who wrote a column, My Manifesto for Despairing Democrats. It gave me some hope. It had some humanity in it. I thought it was a good guide to how to behave as a human being in a reaction to this kind of loss. The things you could do positively to, you know, get involved with organizations that are fighting to uphold human values, to subscribe to real news organizations, and to try better to understand why Americans disagree with us. Also to keep cool. So I just thought it was a very nice piece. I recommend it to our viewers and listeners, and Nicholas Kristof did not disappoint me.
Okay, thank you for that. David Frum.
This is non-election related. So this past week, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration released a statement that said 2024 is on track to be the warmest year on record. European scientists have come up to the same finding. Year's not over yet, but it seems virtually certain. This caps a series of records. This is not the first year that has been the warmest on record. Each year has been the warmest on record since before. I don't regard this as a crisis exactly, but it is a imminent and worsening threat. One of the consequences of the election just had, to make it election focused again, is we are going to spend four more years not doing anything about it. And I truly wonder what the people of the 2050s and 2060s will think when they look back on the period, on how we use the 21st century and did not address this problem that will be so present and difficult for them.
Yeah. And it already is. We're already feeling the effects of it in the devastating flooding and hurricanes, et cetera. Bill Galston.
Well, I have to say I've amazed myself by having enough time in my fevered brain to come up with both a highlight and a lowlight. Let me start with the lowlight. The polling profession, which, you know, I'm just as devoted to as Damon, though perhaps with a somewhat more sour attitude about the whole thing. 4 years ago, the polls in the aggregate nailed Joe Biden's share of the vote, but underestimated Trump's by 3 percentage points. So, you know, the conclave of the wise and the good and the polling establishment got together and decided we have to do something about this. You know, we have to find the missing Trump voters. So they grunted and grunted and didn't even produce a mouse. This time, they nailed Harris's share of the vote, but underestimated Trump's by, you guessed it, 3 percentage points. And I do not share Damon's admiration for the Times-Siena poll, although maybe Nate Cohn, the interpreter, is better than the poll itself, because the New York Times missed it the same as everyone else. Their final poll was 48-48, you know, and so they got Harris right, and they underestimated Trump by 3 percentage points. I think that, you know, the Trump phenomenon has thrown a hand grenade into many things, but from my standpoint, one of the most important is to half blind, you know, the way that we assess public opinion.
Bill, before you go on to your next point, can I just say it could be worse? They could have been Ann Selzer.
Well, yes. but I have to say, my son, you know, who is, you know, well to my right, you know, sent me an email, an admiring email, in which he said, you know, she had a lot of guts and integrity to make that poll public. And that's not a bad way of looking at it. You know, by the way, the very same day, you know, the Emerson Hill poll came out with a poll on Iowa that put Trump up by 10 percentage points, which is almost exactly what happened.
Yep.
So, okay, that was my low light. Here's my highlight. The Washington Post reporter and columnist, Karen Tumulty, is nobody's idea of a conservative. She's my idea of a good human being. That's a different point. But, you know, she was one of 13 columnists and opinionators that the Post consulted. And let me read you from the piece that she published this morning, which I think took almost as much guts to write and publish as Ann Selzer's poll. There will be people who blame the outcome of the election on sexism and racism. They will say that this is a country that simply wouldn't accept a woman of color as its chief executive and commander and chief. Others will say that most Americans are just stupid. But I think, Karen Tumulty says, the main thing that happened Tuesday was an expression of frustration and impatience with a political system so wrapped up in itself that it no longer hears the concerns of ordinary Americans, much less addresses them. For too long, Democrats have been enthralled to their educated, affluent elite. They denied that there was chaos at the border until the impact began to be felt in blue cities. They told less fortunate people that they were imagining the economic stresses in their lives. The statistics, after all, said otherwise. They kept businesses and schools under lockdown during the pandemic, taking a toll on the working class and their children that will not be overcome for years, maybe decades. They refused to see past group identity, race, gender, sexual orientation, to individual circumstances. My hunch is that this will begin an overdue period of soul searching by Democrats, which I hope leads to a realization that they need to do more listening and less lecturing. I present that for the consideration of the panelists and our audience.
Okay. On another podcast, remind me to beg to differ with Karen Tumulty and many others about this new emerging consensus about what went wrong in our handling of COVID, because it is seeming to harden into a view that the biggest mistakes we made were excessive lockdowns. And though the keeping schools closed too long was clearly a mistake that we've all discussed on this podcast, everyone has lost sight of the other side of the coin, where because of the mismanagement of this crisis and the disinformation that was put out by the Trump administration, tens of thousands of people died unnecessarily. And you can look at the data from Republican counties versus Democratic counties and the death rates to prove that. So,
well, you can have that view, which I agree with. And also Karen Tumulty's view. They do not contradict each other.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's important that conventional wisdom about COVID not be allowed to settle, because I think it's wrong. Okay. I would like to cite a low light and a highlight. Obviously, the low light is the election, which is very obvious. But I have another low light, which is Howard Lutnick, person that I had not been on my radar screen until he appeared at that Madison Square Garden rally. He is apparently the chairman of Trump's co-chairman of Trump's transition committee. He is the head of a firm, very famous Wall Street firm called Cantor Fitzgerald. They lost a lot of people on 9/11. And this fellow, you would think, is highly educated, sophisticated person. And he went on one of the TV shows and waxed eloquent about how much RFK Jr. had opened his eyes about the dangers of vaccines. That's the kind of thing we're in for a lot more of now because of the triumph of Trump, and it makes my stomach turn over a bit. But let me say, the highlight is something that people have hinted at during this, the panel has mentioned during this podcast, and it deserves underlining. I've been around a long time. I've been through a lot of election cycles. And I think I can say without fear of too much contradiction that politicians frequently overread their mandates and go too far and get rebuked. And that is not an out of the question outcome for what we just saw. And we are still a free country. We have we have tremendous strengths. We have a vibrant civil society, we do have a free press. And those of us who feel that this is a terrible mistake that the voters have made will get an opportunity to organize and to challenge it and to argue. And for that, we should be grateful and not too despairing. With that, I want to thank our guest, David Frum. I want to thank our regular panel. And of course, our viewers and listeners. Our wonderful producer is Jim Swift. Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.